Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Since he joined the faculty of Emory University 2 decades ago, Dr. Greg Burns has worked to understand how the human brain works. Using MRI technology, he's mapped brain activity as it relates to a wide range of human behavior, including how key parts of the brain function in decision-making, like how people decide to buy stocks, or to figure out which popular songs are likely to become hits. But more recently, Greg has turned his attention to studying how the brains of dogs work. He knows how he felt about the dogs in his household, but like many of us who live with dogs, he wanted to know what his dogs have felt about him. And so he began applying the same MRI technology he's used to study humans on dogs. His research led to his new book, the title of which boldly proclaims what it's like to be a dog. Gregory Burns, welcome to Two-Way Street. You're here to talk about what it's like to be a dog. Just the title alone, Greg, makes me want to dig into this book, because you really did, in your research, get an opportunity to learn to some extent what it is like to be a dog, yes?
The title, What It's Like to Be a Dog, is actually, it's a riff on a very old essay by a philosopher, a guy named Thomas Nagel, who wrote an essay about 40 years ago, and he posed the question. He said, what is it like to be a bat? And the reason he wrote that essay was essentially to argue that we can never know what it's like to be a bat, or frankly, any other animal, or perhaps even another person. And it was all based on this idea that no matter how much you deconstruct the brain, you'll never figure out what it's like to be another animal. And so my view is quite different than that, since I now spend my days studying dogs and what makes them tick.
The real spark that led you to begin this work, I think I'm correct, was you lost a really beloved dog, Newton.
Yeah, right. So I've always been a dog person. I grew up with dogs. And at about the time this idea happened, I had lost my favorite dog, who was a pug, and he had lived to about 15 years old. And when he finally passed away, I think it wasn't conscious, but I think I started wondering, you know, did he love me in kind of any way, shape, or form that I loved him, or was it all about the food? And the other, you know, the other thing about Newton and just dogs in general is there are very few relationships that I can point to in my life that have lasted that long, you know. And I don't think I'm unique in that respect. I mean, you know, my wife, my children, family, but it's kind of a small circle that of people that you have that stay with you that long. And weirdly, I think dogs and pets are in that circle now.
So there's the question that you decided you wanted to look into, for me, has two steps to it. And what I mean by that is, it strikes me that one of the questions really is, are dogs capable of love, period, before turning to whether Newton loved you? Does that feel right to you?
I think there are two levels to it. And this is a real subtlety. So, you know, if you go back to Nagel's original question, what is it like to be a bat? There's kind of implicit to the question, then all bats are the same. I mean, but that's ridiculous. I mean, bats are, you know, there's hundreds of species of bats, and let alone the individuals within the species. And so, you know, it's a fair question when you start talking about dogs. Are all dogs the same? Could they all feel love, or is it just mine?
And now you've added an even third layer to this, because it's not, are dogs capable of love? Did Newton love you? It's, is Newton one of the dogs that is capable of love, while other dogs out there may not be capable of love, in the same way that people have those differences?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And this is kind of the same thing that people don't like to hear often is, you know, sometimes I get asked, well, does my dog love me? And my usual response is, well, I don't know your dog, and I don't know you, so how can I say anything about that?
That's really interesting. All right. So before we go down that rabbit hole, it occurred to you that you could apply some of the same technology, MRIs, to studying the dog brain that you had with humans, human brains before that. And so you began this project that had to start with figuring out how to get a dog into an MRI. For people who have had MRIs, they know, number one, you have to remain incredibly still, and number two, the noises that an MRI makes as it goes through its 20, 30-minute cycle can be disconcerting to a lot of people. I have to tell you, I'm fascinated. I've had several MRIs, and I always want to know, what's that sound? What's happening when it makes this sound? But I don't think most people share my curiosity, and I can't imagine what dogs are like.
I think people actually do share your curiosity, because if you've had to have an MRI, it makes these kind of clicks and whirs and then it bangs, and nobody tells you, you know, what's going on. They just say, hold still.
Yeah.
So, you know, Newton's death, I think, was probably a catalyst, although I probably, in hindsight, say it was subconscious. I did not have the idea to do this, and this is a true story, until the publicity around the Bin Laden mission. So that was back in 2011, and I feel fairly safe in saying I'm probably the only person who had this reaction to it, which was when it came out that there was a dog on the mission, a dog named Cairo, and you saw all these pictures of military working dogs jumping out of helicopters and just doing crazy stuff. That was when I had the idea. It's like, you know, if you can train a dog to jump out of a helicopter, why can't we train one to go into an MRI?
So you started this work. You acquired a dog to replace Newton. You got Callie. Where did you get Callie?
So it wasn't quite as...
No, not
as,
that simple?
It wasn't quite as designed as that sound. So Callie was adopted from the Atlanta Humane Society after Newton died. And so that preceded the idea of scanning dogs. So she just happened to be the dog around the house who was young and curious and full of energy and, you know, seemed willing to do new things.
You describe her as a skinny black terrier.
That is what she is. Still is that way.
All right. So okay, I get it. You hadn't brought her home, brought Callie home specifically to learn how to tolerate an MRI. But in fact, that's what ended up happening.
That is. And so I teamed up with a local dog trainer who I had worked with before, and I approached him and, you know, said, you know, I have this idea. Do you think you can help, you know, train dogs to do this? And he was very open to the idea. The first thing we had to do was he actually had to come in not having had an MRI, sit for one himself, so he knew what we were dealing with. And then from that point on, it was simply a matter of just breaking down the elements. So I ended up building a MRI simulator in my garage, and it parked it in the living room eventually. So it was just this big tube that was the same dimensions as an MRI, and then we recorded the sounds of the scanner makes. And then it was largely a matter of just trial and error in teaching Callie how to go into what we call a head coil, which is the thing that if you were a human, we would put around your head to pick up signals from your brain. But if you're a dog, it's something that you have to shimmy into and stick your head in. And so it was just a lot of trial and error. I ended up having to build a little chin rest and made it out of foam and taught her hand signals because we weren't sure that she would be able to hear us over the scanner noise. So in hindsight, and in retrospect, it sounds fairly straightforward. And in fact, it only took probably about 3 or 4 months to teach her how to do this. But going forward, it was really just trial and error.
Yeah. She likes hot dogs.
Who doesn't?
Callie likes hot dogs, which helped in your training, is the way I think you describe it in the book.
Yes, that's right. So it was fairly trivial, I think, you know, to lure her into this contraption with hot dogs, although I to this day don't think she views it as a contraption or anything strange. It's, you know, it still lives in my basement. And, you know, if I say Callie, coil, she'll run down the basement and just climb into the tube.
Okay, so you get Callie in, and tell us about the first time you actually put Callie in a real MRI, what you saw, and how that started you down the path to further research.
So literally the first time was a disaster. The first time we went to the MRI, we hadn't quite worked out the positioning of her head. So the main issue was she would go into the scanner, she'd get a treat, then she'd come out, then she'd put her head back in, and it wasn't in the same position. And so we were like trying to get snapshots of a moving target. So then it was back to the drawing board. But once we revised the chin rest and she learned to put her head in the same position, it was pretty smooth going. And so the very first thing that we did was really a page out of the psychology textbook going all the way back to Pavlov. And the reason we did this was because we didn't know if anything was going to work, that we didn't know what we were going to see. So it was just a test of the whole technology. And all we did was we had taught her two hand signals, where one hand signal meant hot dog and the other hand signal meant nothing. So it was a control. And so I would simply go in with her in the scanner. So she'd crawl in and I'd come around the back and we'd be looking at each other. And then I would hold up my hand. And if it was the hot dog, then I'd give her a piece of hot dog. And if it was the no hot dog signal, then she gets nothing. And so when we looked at the activity that occurred later, comparing those two signals, we found that it resulted in activity in what we call the reward system part of her brain, an area called the caudate nucleus. And so that's exactly where you would expect this to happen. It's the area of the brain with the most dopamine receptors. And from everything we know in neuroscience, it's critical for motivation, possibly involved in pleasure and liking. And so it showed that the technique works, that she would hold still enough that we could get enough data and that we could interpret it.
So that was about just making sure you could do the data. Clearly it wasn't a surprise that her brain responded to a hot dog rather than nothing.
Well, that's right. So the colleagues who asked me why I was doing this were equally unimpressed when I told them that my dog likes hot dogs.
All right, so let's talk about this. Let's broaden this out just a little bit. What are some of the first findings? One of the things you essentially tell us is, I think I'm right, and I want to make sure I've got it right, so I'm looking at notes. You decided after your studies that there is a there's a structure-function relationship between human brains and the dog brains that you studied, and that we all have similar brains and therefore likely have similar subjective experiences. That sounds a little mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, so that's, I would say, something that I came to now after years of doing this.
Yeah.
And so after Callie, you know, we were convinced that the technique worked. Then we put out word of mouth, other dog owners in Atlanta, you know, hey, join the project. You want to train your dog to be in the MRI, see what they're thinking. And it was pretty fast at that point, you know, so we had volunteers. We started holding MRI class every other Sunday. And, you know, we kind of grew this citizen science project where we have these cohorts of dogs, which are still active. We've now trained and scanned 100 dogs. And so when you start to get up to numbers like that, and many of these dogs keep participating, doing multiple experiments, you start to get a sense for what's common to dogs. So back to the original question is like, what it's like to be a dog versus what is it like to be a particular dog, and what are the range of responses and characteristics? So, to get back to your question about, you know, what is the similarity and differences between dogs and humans, what we can say is that, first of all, we're both mammals, so we share a common ancestry in terms of evolution that goes way back. And when you look at mammal brains, there are many things in common. There's some things that are different, but focusing on the things that are in common, we see things like the reward system. That was the thing that we studied originally. In fact, we can use that as a sort of gauge for what an animal person or non-person is engaged with at that moment. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we did later on was to use that structure in the dog's brain as a gauge for what they like or what they like at that particular moment and get to the original question of, well, do they love us for something other than food? And so we did an experiment later where it was a variation on the hand signal experiment where we introduced another condition. So in addition to getting food, there was another condition in which their owner simply just popped into view and praised them and said,
good
girl.
The dog could choose food or choose the owner or the master or whatever the word would be, or any human.
Well, right. So that was the behavioral test. But yeah. In the scanner, they didn't have to do anything. So we simply would hold up a signal that says, hey, you're going to get a piece of food, or a different signal that says, hey, your owner's going to pop in view and say, good girl. And then we use the same structure to read out essentially which one do they like more, mm-hmm. without even having to ask them to do a behavior, because behavior gets very confusing, I think, with dogs. And what we found was that the majority of dogs had equal responses to the expectation of food as well as praise. And there, of course, is kind of a spectrum. So there's some that are at either end, some who really seem to like the praise. And one dog in particular, who's a Vizsla, whose name is Velcro, because he sticks to his owner, was one of those dogs. And then there were a couple who were at the other end who really were all about the food.
So what does that tell you?
So, like humans, there is a range of kind of, I would say, capacities for, let's say, types of relationships, ranging from the purely transactional, and I'm being purposely vague, this could be a dog, it could be humans, you know, up to something that is very close to empathic and reciprocal.
Pretty simply transactional would be, give me a treat, right?
Right.
Okay.
Are we talking about dogs or people?
Yeah. Both.
Exactly.
Doesn't that operate for both humans and dogs?
Exactly. Yes.
One of the things that you learned that you call a hallmark quality of dogs is that they lack self-control. The first question I ask about that is, what do you mean? What kind of self-control? And then how did you learn they lack it?
So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. So I would say that they're not known to be masters of self-control, because in my household, we have dogs who still to this day, you know, will go through the garbage, they'll go through the laundry basket, chew up underwear, you know, bark at the mailman, do all these things that we would say, you know, it's like, you know, stop that. Stop doing that. Can't you stop doing that? You know, I have one dog whose nickname is Sir Bark-a-Lot, and that's what he does. He can't help himself. So there are other dogs, and I would say it varies depending on the circumstances in a dog's ability to exert self-control, meaning that they have to inhibit those tendencies if the situation calls for it. And I think dogs are not terribly good at that, as you know, certainly in compared to people.
So I have two dogs. If I offer treats to both of them when they're together, Pepper will sit quietly, let me drop the treat in front of him. When I go to give it to Uncle Gus, he grabs at it as quickly as he sees it in my hand. Is that an example of Pepper having more self-control than Uncle Gus?
It's hard to say, right? Because one could be subordinate to the other and simply defer, you know, to the other dog. So probably the better example is countersurfing. And maybe your dogs are not large enough to countersurf. Some of mine are. And that is uniformly not an acceptable behavior in pretty much any dog household, as far as I know. No human likes their dog surfing the counter for treats. So what are the consequences of that to the dog? Well, usually the dog gets yelled at. So either that doesn't have any significance to the dog, or maybe it does, because they don't like to be yelled at. So why do they do it? It could be they just can't help themselves, right? The food is just too alluring. So that, to me, is an issue of self-control. And I think it's actually quite important to understand, because it's these lapses of self-control, as at least from the human's perspective, that often lands dogs in shelters and you know, causes people to surrender them, because the dogs are doing things that the humans find unacceptable. So maybe it's the case that dogs don't know what is right and wrong according to human rules, or maybe they do, but like, you know, one of my dogs, they just can't help it.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Tell me about the marshmallow test.
Yeah, so the marshmallow test is this very old psychology test, very old meaning 1960s and 70s, and it was invented by a psychologist to study self-control in children. And so in the classic version of this test, what they would do was they would bring a kid in, typically maybe 5, 6 years old, and they'd put the kid in a room. And they would tell them, they say, okay, if you can wait, say, 15 minutes, you'll get your favorite treat. Maybe it's a cookie, maybe it's a marshmallow, whatever it is. That's why it's called the marshmallow test. And then they would give the kid a bell, and the kid would have to stay there. And if he decided he didn't want to wait anymore, he could ring the bell, and then the experimenter would come back in and give him something, but not his favorite treat. So it'd be something of lesser value. And so this ability to delay gratification was taken as a test of self-control. And this is some of the original work in delayed gratification in people. And the reason it's important is because there's a tremendous variation in kids' ability to do this. And when they followed the kids for years, you know, they followed them for decades, actually, the original kids, what they found were that the kids who could delay gratification, even when they're 5 or 6 years old, they just did better in life. They scored higher on the SAT. They earned more money. It just became clear as time went on that the ability to kind of inhibit these impulses and delay gratification is very adaptable in modern society.
Yeah. So, in humans, that's a simple observational test, and it's a psychological test. But you wanted to figure out how the marshmallow test might apply to dogs, right?
Right. So, again, it kind of comes back to this issue of self-control. And, you know, clearly some dogs are better at self-control. And so we wanted to devise a version of the marshmallow test that we could not only do in a dog, but more importantly, study what parts of their brain are responsible for it. So it had to be a version that we could do in the MRI. And what we settled on is something much simpler than the marshmallow test. It's actually called the go-no-go task. This was also lifted from experimental psychology, actually child psychology. And it's an even simpler thing. It's basically, In people, what you do is typically you do this on a computer where you show symbols on a screen, and when they see a particular target, maybe it's an X, they have to hit a button. So what happens is if you do this a lot, it becomes kind of almost second nature. You just see X, hit the button, X button, X button. And then you introduce a condition where you have to inhibit that impulse. So maybe you just change the instructions. So now when you see an X, don't hit the button. So put on the brakes. It's actually fairly difficult to do. Kind of once you get in the in the motion, then you literally have to override.
Your reflexes take over.
Right, and you have to override it.
Yeah.
So when you do this with people and you study what parts of their brain are involved in that, you find a particular part of the frontal lobe, which is sometimes we call it the executive function part of the brain. It seems to be critical for kind of these conscious thoughts to, you know, essentially take control of your body and, you know, override these impulses. So when people do this, you see that part of the brain active.
Okay, before we move to the dog version of that, what's the practical application of what you learn when you identify the part of the brain that's dealing with that impulse?
So some of it is just straight up, we're trying to map out what different parts of the brain do. But the interesting thing, I think, is the fact that different people have different levels of activation, and that correlates with their ability to do these types of tasks. So amazingly, the kids who did the original marshmallow test were actually scanned on this task decades later. And someone kind of tracked them down, had them do this go, no-go task. And remarkably, the kids who were then kids 40 years ago who did better on that had more activity in this part of their frontal lobe when they were doing this task. So it's amazing to me that it suggests that not only are we able to identify what parts of the brain are responsible for this very particular function, but that there are kind of deeply ingrained patterns that seem to track through life. And some people are better at it than others. And so it's simply the same idea then to take that and do that with dogs.
Okay. You went on in the go, no-go test to develop a dog version.
That's right. So the dog version was just like the computer version, except we use a dog whistle. So what we did was we placed a little target in front of the dogs. So this is on their chin rest that goes in the MRI. And we taught them when they hear the dog whistle, they nose poke this target. So that's pretty easy to teach the dogs. Callie picked that up in a day. And so we practiced this to the point where it just becomes second nature for them. Then what we did was we introduced a new hand signal. And in this experiment, it was holding up the arms in a kind of X cross-like signal. And that means don't poke the target, even when you hear the whistle.
Wow.
So that's quite difficult, actually, to teach the dogs because you can't just say what I said. You have to kind of shape their behavior, rewarding it when they do it correctly and not rewarding it when they don't. But ultimately, we did teach the dogs this. It took about 6 months to teach the dogs that trick. We do it in the scanner, and then we see what parts of the brain are active when they're putting on the brakes, when they hear the dog whistle, but when they have this hand signal that says, don't poke the target. And amazingly, what we found was the analogous part of their brain being active as we see in humans, this part of their frontal lobe in essentially the same location. And this is pretty amazing because that part of the dog's brain does look quite different than humans. Their brain is about the size of a lemon, so it's much smaller than ours. And so, as I say, they don't have the real estate to do a lot of the things that we do. So the fact that they have this part of the brain to do it, to do this version of the marshmallow test, is significant because it started to grow this idea that I've been thinking about, that when you do essentially the same task in a human as well as a dog, and you see the same pattern of activity in corresponding parts of their brain in a human and a dog, it seems reasonable to conclude that they're experiencing something very similar to us.
Yeah, this is one of the things that led you to this conclusion that the dog brain, the animal brain, operates in much the same way that the human brain does.
That's right, at least in domains that it can do things that are similar. There are domains that there are clear differences, you know, language, for example. They don't speak to us.
Yeah, but I'm glad you mentioned language because that's really an interesting part of your research, and it's something I think that those of us who are dog owners always wonder about. The question you ask is, do animals understand that spoken words have meaning? So when I say to my dogs, when my wife or my kid, we say, time to go outside, go potty, they head straight for the back door. When we say, go to bed, good night, they go right to their crates in their room. Strikes me, they understand language. What am I missing?
It seems that way. And when we talk about language, especially with other animals and dogs in particular, this is where I think we run the risk of anthropomorphism. So the circumstances you describe, it could be that they understand what you said. But we also know that dogs are very context dependent. So they meaning that they know that particular time of day. You say, it's time to go outside or it's time to go to bed. Well, they've learned through repetition that, okay, when it's dark outside, I mean, they know it's time for bed because they have internal clocks like we do. And they know when they hear those particular sounds, it means, okay, let me go outside, go potty, then I go to bed. My dogs do the same thing. Does that mean that they literally understand what you've said? Not really. I mean, they can parse the sounds, perhaps, and maybe they just associate the sounds in that particular context, at that particular time of day, with that particular action. And that would be something quite different than literally understanding what you say. But I don't actually think it's quite that rudimentary, shall we say. I think there is something a bit more to it than that.
Yeah, don't break my heart, Greg. What does Callie hear when you call her by name? What do you think she hears?
So I think when we call a dog by name, and when I say Callie, I think to her that means, hey, better look at the person who said that because something interesting is going to happen.
No matter whether you're using her name or not, she doesn't recognize her name is what you're saying.
She recognizes that that refers to her in the sense that she has to look and direct her attention at whoever said it. I think that's a step different from the way we use names, which is that it creates a sense of self and that we equate that with I or me. Those are very different things.
She doesn't know she's Callie. She doesn't internalize that is what you're saying.
Exactly. So it's possible that they do that, but so far, you know, it seems unlikely. It seems everything that we're seeing in how dogs react and how their brains react, it seems that they're very action-oriented, which makes sense.
Yeah.
It's probably not the case that most animals have the need for nouns in their world. And, you know, it's more important that if we're trying to teach dogs or other animals language, that it's a more natural thing to teach them actions. And I think we know that because we can teach dogs to do things. Much harder to teach them, you know, I'm Greg, my daughter's Helen. Those are somewhat abstract reference.
So here's my sort of philosophical question about this. And we're going to come back and do a few more observational things, but if Callie, if Uncle Gus, if Pepper, if they don't recognize their names, if they don't know that's who they are, if they're only responding, they get the vocalization. Does that in some way distance us from our own animals? Does it make us wonder about what that relationship really is about?
Well, I don't think it's quite as cynical as that because it's not the case that they don't know who they are. So this gets into this philosophical question of sense of self, right?
Right.
So they clearly have a sense of self because it's not like they confuse their body with another dog's body. So every animal has to know where their physical body ends and the environment starts, right? That's just kind of basic, you know, body control. And I think that is the purpose of a brain fundamentally, is to control our bodies so that we can go out and do things and survive in the world. Everything else is just kind of added on top of that.
Right.
So it's not to say that they don't have a sense of self, but I don't think that it really takes much away from them if they don't kind of equate Callie with self. So what? It's not necessary for the dog-human relationship for it to be that abstract.
Okay, I want to explore a quote. Our results have shown, no matter which animal's brain we examined, that if it has a cortex, the animal is very likely sentient, and that it has subjective experience that can be understood by degrees of similarity to ours. It doesn't matter if it is a bat or a dolphin, a sea lion, or a marsupial. What do you mean by that statement?
So, to me, this idea of sentience, so people throw out words like sentience or consciousness, and they have subtly different meanings. But the idea of sentience is being aware of what's happening to you, okay? So historically, you go back centuries, you go back to Descartes, you know, or the Greeks, animals have not generally been thought of as being sentient. They've been historically thought of as kind of automatons, just reflexes, but not thinking in any way like a human. As science has progressed, and neuroscience in particular, what we've realized is that when you get to the level of complexity of a mammalian brain, and it doesn't really matter, I think, what kind of mammal it is, you're at a very high level of sophistication, and just based on the number of neurons, the number of connections, that system is likely to have levels of awareness similar to us, not exactly the same, but kind of on par with us knowing what's happening to it. So that is, by definition, sentience. So it wasn't until recently that animals were even thought to feel pain.
Yeah.
But of course they do, and of course they're aware of it. So, and we can look at the pathways in the brain that are responsible for transmitting the signals from the parts of the body to the brain, and we know a lot about that system, and we see it in every animal that we look at.
So if animals are sentient, if dogs are sentient beings, and they're aware of what's happening, we often say that the one thing that separates humans from all other species of animals is that we're the one species that knows we're going to die. We know that animals experience danger because we can see them physically react to a dangerous situation. We don't know their brain activity. You may know what the brain activity is. I don't, but I see they're reacting out of fear. Is it possible they understand that the ultimate outcome of whatever is happening to make them afraid is that they're going to die?
That's a great question. I don't know yet what they're capable of. So the way I would approach that question, and I don't know if it's answerable, but we can break it down. So usually when you pose a question like that, you have to say, okay, well, what would it take cognitively to know that, okay? So the first thing that an animal would have to have is the ability to cast themselves into the future, right? So if you're talking about mortality and you're talking about the possibility of, you know, what is or is not beyond death, what that requires is the ability to project yourself into the future and kind of imagine those possibilities.
Well, except that if I'm threatened and in a fearful situation, it may be because I'm in fear of imminent death. Forget about I understand that someday I'm going to die. If a man comes at me with a knife, I'm fearful of imminent death.
Well, right. And certainly, I don't think there's any doubt that animals are afraid of that. Because, you know, if you hunt an animal or animals that are hunted by other animals, they will run away. They try to.
Okay.
So either you accept that they have some kind of conceptualization of death and that it's not good, or you have to go back to Descartes' view that they're just reflexes. It's possible. Certainly there's a reflexive component to this, absolutely, because something as important as life itself, you cannot trust to mere consciousness, right? You have to, you have to react and then perhaps think about it.
Has anything in the research you're doing so far and are going to continue to do pointed you in a direction that would help us understand better ways to train our dogs?
I think so. I mean, that's my hope. So, you know, some of the things that have come out of it, so the self-control test, the marshmallow test, and looking at frontal lobe activity, I think that was kind of the first thing that we did that had perhaps actual application. Because what it tells me is that when dogs don't do what you want them to do, it's oftentimes very difficult to tell whether it's because they don't understand, or they understand and they don't want to do it, or they understand and they can't help themselves regardless. So this idea of using functional MRI to kind of parse out which circuits are being evoked is a potential pathway forward, because it gets kind of minimally, do they understand, first of all? And then kind of secondarily, if they understand, then get at their motivations for why they do something or not.
Yeah. I have to tell you, as we're talking, I have this science fiction vision in my head. My dog's like yours, from the Atlanta Humane Society. And suddenly I have this vision in my head that in the future, because of your research, when I walk in to find a dog again, in addition to the little information sheets, Gus is a friendly dog that likes other dogs. There's going to be a video on a screen that's going to show the brain activity of each dog, and there's going to be a little description of what that tells me about that particular dog. That's a scary science fiction vision, Greg.
I don't think it's scary at all. In fact, we've already done a version of that.
Really?
So, and this is not in the book, so this is why this is surprising. So we did a spin-off project where we teamed up with a group that trains service dogs. So we teamed up with Canine Companions for Independence. And we had this idea of, if we could incorporate the MRI training into the dog's regular training, could we do an fMRI test and predict which dogs would be good service dogs? And so the answer is, in fact, we could.
I find one of the funniest things about dogs is that they cannot comprehend what I consider one of the most simple human gestures imaginable, pointing. When I'm looking at you and I point to the logo for our show on the wall, my finger directs your attention to the two-way street logo. Dogs can't do that for anything in the world. What's that about?
Well, it's your dogs can't do that.
Can your dog do that?
No, my dogs can't do it either. But so there's a scientist, Brian Hare, now at Duke University, says they can do that. And actually, he's created a test of sorts, kind of for your dogs. It could be kind of a measure of how well they're attuned to you, perhaps. So some dogs can do it. Now, what I actually find interesting, so for a long time, people thought, well, that's something special then about dogs being domesticated and living around humans who do a lot of pointing at stuff. So it's possible that you could just, with enough practice, train your dog, maybe.
They stare at the end of our fingers.
I'm with you. That's what my dogs do, too. However, the thing that actually is really interesting about it is that a few years ago, someone did the same thing with wolves. So there's a few places in the world where they're not domesticated. They call it socialized wolves. So these are wolves that have been raised around humans since birth. So they will tolerate people without biting them. And amazingly, the wolves can follow points even better than dogs. Part of it is because they're so big. So if you, they're just kind of more on the level of humans. You know, when they come up to your hip, you know, they're kind of more at, you know, the level of your hands, the level of your eyes, but they do follow points.
So as we come to a close, I want to just pick up on a couple of aspects of your research, because it takes us back to this notion of how our animals relate to us and we to them. You say a couple of things. You say, I've come to the conclusion that communication with animals is possible, but only on a low bandwidth channel. When it comes to verbal communication, simple verb object statements are probably the best one can hope for. So that's one thing that helps us understand how we're relating to the dogs that we love. And then you say, dogs, you make the observation, dogs come wired to process human faces. And if we're hopeful that our dogs do love us, it strikes me that really both of those things, but particularly the second one, that dogs can process human faces, maybe gives us the best assurance that what we hope is there might really be there, yes?
I think so. You know, dogs are special, you know, and I say that not because I'm a dog person, but because they were the first animals to live with humans. You know, there's some debate about how long ago that happened, but I think it predates agriculture. I think dogs are what would be called a proto-dog, perhaps, have been with humans for at least 20, maybe 30,000 years. So there is what we call coevolution going on, in the sense that humans affected the evolution of dogs, and I think it's also very possible that dogs affected the evolution of humans, meaning that the type of person who would accept a dog, or maybe even way back a wolf, into their community had to have been a very special type of person, perhaps with social skills that transcend what was the norm at the time, you know, the ability to kind of be a wolf whisperer or something. And that could have a lot of advantages for communicating with other humans and may be very desirable and may, in fact, kind of be the catalyst that made us what we are today in terms of social creatures. So the dog-human relationship is, I think, a two-way street in the sense that it can't be all us projecting on them, that there's a bond there that goes back thousands of years, and that, in fact, that it can't be just about food, that there has to be more to it than that.
But Callie knows your face. Callie has processed your face and recognizes it. You could go on vacation for a week and leave Callie with loving friends who take good care of Callie. But when you come back, she knows it's you.
Of course she knows it's me. And it's not just the face. It's the way I smell, too. It's the way I move. It's all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of which leads to this notion that there really is a special relationship. You've essentially said it. Did you come to the final question? Did you come to the conclusion that you started this off with? Did Newton have the ability, as an individual dog, to love you?
I think so. And you know, even though he loved food as much as any dog, I can look back on instances when his decision, you know, whether it's to, you know, cuddle up with me at night, or even just after eating, these are not things that are contingent on food. It's just because he wanted to be there at that moment.
Yeah, but did the activity that you discovered in the brains of dogs help you understand the answer to that question?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the experiment with praise versus food was probably the closest proof that one can come to that it's not all about the food. And not for the majority of dogs, it isn't.
Greg Burns, your book is What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. I think you said at the beginning, you know, I think you said it before we started taping. You've spent all these years studying to be a neuroscientist and do that work now. And at the same time, you get to play with dogs every day. That's pretty cool.
It is very cool.
Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
We've posted more information about Greg Burns' book on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. You'll also find a link to Burns' previous book about his research on dogs. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. Jenny edited today's show. She grew up with four dogs at different times in her house: Shikari, Pokey, Scarlet, and Doc. Our producer is Olivia Rheingold. The dogs she grew up with were Buddy, Hubert, and Zoe. Our engineer is Tyler Morris, and sadly, he didn't have dogs in his house at all. I'm Bill Nigut. As I said earlier, my family shares our house with Pepper and Uncle Gus. Thanks for listening today. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.